I guess we can begin. I'd like to begin by playing a musical instrument for you. The first day I was here, I went up to the tailings and found an old rusty saw. And this is a piece of wood from the shop. I'd like to play the saw for you. Find the was not creative. Songs have been played as musical instruments for a long, long time. The name of the instrument is called a plectrum. It's like a saw blade. And years ago, you could buy these in a chrome plated. They had two strings on the handles. And it was a sound-producing instrument. And in fact, some composers actually write music for a plectrum. Now, I played a musical saw, or not a musical saw, but a saw since I was in high school, mainly because I needed a saw to make a sound, and I was serious enough to practice on the instrument and to be a saw player. Recently, the Lincoln Symphony gave a concert, and they played a piece of Pachitorian, and there was a 32 major for plectrum. And the composer or the conductor asked anyone in the instrument whether someone can play a plectrum or a saw. And I don't know whether I'm the only saw player in the bachelor or not, but I had an opportunity to wear a tuxedo and play a 32 measure solo. It was my first public appearance after all of since high school, and actually I played this instrument. So we have a feeling of a hierarchy of musical instruments. The most noble one is a pipe organ, and then you work your way down to the other instruments. The point is that what I just did was not anything creative. Maybe the first person who thought of a sound, the possibility of producing a sound on a blade, really was a creative, you see. And maybe there is a difference between imagination and creativity. And as far as I'm concerned, imagination is an extension of something. It's like if we have bridges made out of wood, and somebody comes around and says, we can make better bridges if we use steel. That might be an imaginative idea where you go from wood to steel. The creator would say, why have bridges? And so imagination is a linear thing, it just changes. But creativity, who feels creativity opposes and not head with what is. So getting back to sound producing instruments, maybe, well, I have to tell you, I went to the orchestra practice in Lincoln, and they asked me what I did. Someone played the 32 major composition on a tape recorder. See, there are no notes on here, but I have to memorize it by memorizing it. So someone played it on the violin, I put it on the tape, then I played the tape, and then I practiced the 32 major. So then I had to go to Lincoln for the practice with the orchestra for my part. And so I got there first night, and I asked the conductor when I was supposed to sit, or he was sitting there somewhere with a violin. And I sat with a percussionist in a game of basketball, and my father came and asked me to play with that, and he said, I can't hear you. And so he smoked in front. So I sat with a violin in front, and then I played my part. And during the practice, this elderly lady who's been playing the violin all her life, and she's been very proficient in the instrument, she kept staring at me. Total disbelief. She just looked at me and said, that's just an old saw. I said, yeah. I didn't tell her, you just have a box with tap jack, you say. But really, she just had a box. And I had a saw. But somehow we get wrapped up in the hierarchy of the wonderful musical instrument, the violin, the pipe organ. And maybe we should think about sound. Sound! Whatever sound you want. Okay? And then if you think of sound, then you might actually think of something else that makes a sound other than pipe organ and violin. And you know yourself that right now the church is realizing this, that finally we're lowering our standards so that we allow guitars to play in church and play. But the sound is sound. And the conductor could never hear me, and he kept asking me, and he asked the first violin, he said, I was sitting next to him, and he said, can you all hear him? And he said, well, I can hear him, but I can't believe it. But that night they had a little microphone right down here so they could pick up the sounds of the saw. 10 years ago, I want this to be kind of expose, and these are two stories to point out, you know, what the creative act is like, and maybe I'll tell two stories, these moments of insight, you can get at what the creative act is like. 10 years ago, I was in my sabbatical in Oakland, California. And I worked in sculpture at Mills College, and I did a lot of sculpture with a welding torch and some work. So one day, I got some brass going on because they looked nice. Then I wanted to do a piece of sculpture of the planet, sun, moon, and stars. And I thought I'd go take this brass doorknob and I welded some little wires to the handle of the doorknob. Welded them on. And I was looking at the sun. I was polished up that thing to the sun. Then I became curious. And I think part of creativity is just curiosity. What if? What if? So, when no one was looking, and I was the only one in the room, there was one other person very attentive. He couldn't see what I was doing. So I checked to see where the other man was looking. And looking, and I listened to the doorknob. Now imagine, listening to a doorknob. Which is an irrational, illogical act. And I want to say that the creative act is illogical and irrational the moment that it's conceived. So when no one was looking, I put that doorknob to my ear and I strummed those wires and I heard a sound like no other sound I had ever heard in my life. I just yelled out, what? And so this other instructor was in the room, and so I put his ear and I stumbled wide. Wow! And so I thought if one was wow, maybe we can make like earphones and have two of them. So I got another doorknob, weld some wires on, and put a little piece of metal across it. So you sit on your ears, and you strum these wires, and you shut out all other sounds, and no other person can hear what you hear, because all the sound goes into the inner chamber and goes into the ear. And you have this fantastic celestial sound. And I walked around the campus, and I'm wearing this thing with these wires, and I was playing, I was in another world, and I went to the snack bar, and I sat there and ordered some coffee, and I was playing it. And all the people started gathering and wondering, what's he listening to? Because the sound is not projected, no one else can hear it but you. So they're wondering, what is this horrible thing doing to this man? So then I pass it around, of course, everyone was like, wow. Okay. It's an unbelievable thing. So then, this was 10 years ago, this was a Martin Linklater, had a toy manufacturing company in Los Angeles. So they have a company policy that says you can't send any project to this place. You can only send drawings for ideas, toy ideas. So I wrote him a letter and I said, I have something, I can't send you drawings, but you have to experience it. I'm going to put it in a box, and I don't care what the company says. I want you to put this on your head and look at it. So I sent it to them, and I got a letter back. This is the most fantastic thing we have ever had in our lives. So I signed over all rights to the Link manufacturing company for a year, or 10 years, something like that. In the meantime, they tried to manufacture into a $1.98 toy. And they went to Japan and all over trying to translate this metallic thing into something saleable. And after 3 years of trying, they sent it back to me in Nebraska and released all that back to me. So for 10 years, this thing has been sitting in my basement. And when company comes over, they can enjoy it and the sound. This past year, I had some correspondence with someone from the Museum of Contemporary Craft in New York City, Paul Smith, who had the up. And I just wrote him about something, and then I thought of my earphones, and I said, Paul, I have something really strange in my basement, and I just want to share it with you. I'm going to put it in a box, I'm going to send it to you, I want you to put it in your head, and you listen to it, and you send it right back. So I sent it to him, and by the weekend I got a letter from Paul Smith, and he said, the most fantastic thing I've ever heard in my life. Everybody in the office likes it. In fact, the so-and-so is arranging a sound exhibition at the Museum of Contemporary Craft in New York this fall, and I would suggest that we put this in the show. And Ray Karate is in California now arranging the show. When he comes back, I'll show it. So a couple of days later, Ray got back to New York and got the letter. Wow! Fantastic! We've got to have it in the show. In fact, we need some more because thousands of people are going through the show and we need people to listen to this, and so we need three or four more like it. I call it Moon Music Makers. And so I made some more. And they were going to suspend it on the thin wire and people could stand underneath it and listen to it. So instead of making three or four more just like it, I made some variations on the theme. I put some ice tongs, some big ice tongs, I put some brass knobs on the end, and the little wires, but when you suspend an ice tong, there's a pressure pushing in, and it pushes against your head, and you get a beautiful sound. So I made four variations on the theme. While I was making these four things, I was cutting, I had a coil of spring piano wire in my senior floor. Okay, I needed some of this wire. I was cutting it up. Okay, so I just wired this coil, I'm making this coil. So, there was no one there to help me, so I put the end of the wire in my mouth, like this, to hold it. And I took that wire and I cut that coil. Then for a split second, this thing bounced on the floor, and my head was a resonator, like a doorknob. And I got this strange, beautiful sound. I said, no, not again! And it was not any sound like a doorknob at all, because this was a whanging sound. And here, while I was doing the innovation of this, I was discovering another newness. And I call the second one the wanger. Now all it is, I put a a doorknob on the end of it, which closes on your body like this, and you grab the handle, put the doorknob to your ear like this, and you balance like this, and when it hits the floor, you get this nice, eternal sound. And then a variation of that was to have earphones, two doorknobs, one coil here, one coil here, and then you walk. That was the anger. The point is, that you have to be expectant. You have to not get so carried away with what you're doing that you just then turn off some split second opportunity. And these moments that, now that moment when I cut that wire was just a split second. If I wasn't ready for that sound, I would have lost the idea. Or if I wasn't curious enough to listen to a doorknob, I would never have discovered that. So one point I want to make is that the fear of that is really a very irrational act because it always opposes you and it's so illogical. I think this is why few people want to get involved in the creative act because they want to be so rational and so logical and so practical that they don't want to make this giant step which maybe borders on a 6 seconds of insanity almost, you know, where you become a fool. And really, maybe when every new idea is born, that moment of birth, you're a fool until more people accept the idea. Well, it took a lot of courage for four people in the whole universe to wear long hair. Now that was a very, maybe not too creative because long hair, the idea of long hair is not new. But for them to do that and have the whole world laugh and chuckle, and now it's very easy to wear long hair. It's not hard. But it takes a lot of courage to be a fool for a moment. Another point I want to make. Leo mentioned yesterday, he mentioned a word last night, I really like the word serendipity. And the word serendipity means the faculty of making happy chance discoveries. The faculty of making happy chance discoveries. That's serendipity. And I believe in Christian serendipity. And I mentioned when I said the slide the other day that finally, when you accept Christ, your whole life is a total yes, yes, yes. And that finally God gives man many, 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 many opportunities to accept him, to say yes, or whatever it is. And I just have a feeling that so often our day is too planned. We try to be too logical about things. And we ought to be free enough, and freedom not in the sense of you relax, but freedom in the sense that you're ready to crouch and to pounce on a split second which is given to you. And so this being open enough for ideas is not a slouch, it's a crouch. You're actually all tensed up to grab some moment. You see, there are scientists looking for the cure for cancer. And imagine all these scientists pouring all the liquids from vial to vial, and they're looking. And unless they're anticipating and all tensed up, when that moment finally comes, by George, he ought to be ready to grab that moment and say, I found it. You see? So all the guys looking for the cure for cancer are not just looking around and working, but they are anticipating something they don't know anything about. They don't know that magic moment. They don't know the formula. They don't know the mixture. So they have to be ready all the time for all of these combinations. Because when the right moment is there, they'll have to be able to grab it. And I think to be creative, you have to be entirely tolerant. I use the word tolerant so much. You have to be tolerant. You can't be biased about pipe organs, this thing, that, windows, all the biases that we have. You see, you finally have to be tolerant of possibilities, of change. I have another story to tell. Maybe you want to say something there.
Yeah, I've gone for a walk with Mark, and we were going to go up to the garage, and it was only going to take 10 minutes, and it took about 3 hours, because he was doing this crouching and pouncing all the way. And before we got down to the bridge, we'd made 16 earth pieces, arranged the stones, and picked up the bark and the gum wrappers, and then there was that enticing pile of logs by the sound, and they had to be rearranged. Finally got up to the top of the hill. Our purpose for being here is for all of us to sort of show and tell about moments that we think there is this breakthrough. I'm a different kind of person from Mark, and he put an emphasis on chance and accident, sort of play. And I have this habit of playing, and I guess people in the arts are sort of eternal adolescents rebelling against their dad. Frank Lloyd Wright was still kicking his dad when he was late 80s, and Picasso is still horsing around, and he's 90. Somehow you keep this constructive impulse and this play impulse that you grow up with. Children are curious about mud and what it looks like to rub color crayons on the wallpaper, and maybe I don't recognize that in myself. I know I play most of the time because I'm very lazy and I just hate to do anything that doesn't feel like play. But I'd like to underline sweat. And I don't tend to use the word creativity. I just talk about making and working. Partly because the word is just a beauty. Let's be creative, or let's be artistic, or something like this. Or we have creative something hours, or creative symposiums, and so on. And I don't think around an art studio one hears the word creativity, or in a chemistry lab, or in some of these places. Rather, I guess I think more in terms of just plain work. And none of these things are easy. And I regret having to make paintings, because it's just such horrible hard work. And but I made a commitment, and I can't let myself stop doing that. But I think it would be a lot more fun to be a creative, if you could use that word, a creative spectator, and just watch what somebody else is doing. I remember these moments of breakthrough, but I think it comes only after a lot of hard work, starting sort of where I was, sort of repeating something, repeating an organization or a solution to a problem, and then just telling myself I'm not satisfied with it and doing it again tomorrow. I was telling Mark I have a big television set up here, and there are 10 channels. And I don't work very quickly, and it takes 3 weeks or a month to come up with an idea to make a breakthrough. And I I go around each during the day and I turn on channel 3 and see if I've made any progress on that problem. And maybe I'm doing some activities that relate to channel 3, or maybe they don't. Maybe they kind of fit into something that's going on in channel 8. But you keep all these problems going on these various channels, and then I remember one breakthrough, this light finding the doorknob. They're listening to the doorknobs, and I was on the telephone listening to the registrar bawl me out for not turning my grades in or something, and I kind of didn't listen to her, and all of a sudden I saw this painting or this relationship. And I don't know where it came from, except that I had been working with it, struggling with it for a long time. I guess the creative moment is a rare kind of moment, and there are situations, I'm sure, in everybody's life where everything's just suddenly fallen into place, and you enter into some kind of dynamic relationship with your doorknobs or your crystal structures or your word patterns or your historical relationships or whatever it is, and you become one with them, and the end product seems to emerge. But I would still say that you got to that moment where you stood outside of yourself and got inside of the problem by coming at it through slow, painful steps, like trudging up a mountain. Let's see, maybe would you like to react to that?
Yeah, I would agree with you. I want to tell a true story to point that up. In our house, we had a chest of drawers, and the function of the chest of drawers was that we could clean out our pockets at the end of the day and put our things into the drawer. And my wife had a drawer, and I had a drawer, and Carl had a drawer, and Paul had a drawer. So we could kind of empty out our pockets into these drawers. One day I couldn't find something. It wasn't that important. It was just something I couldn't find. And this happened on a Thursday. Couldn't find it. But I looked for it. I looked for it in my office, I looked for it in the basement, I looked for it in places where I usually hang out. And I couldn't find it. And you know how to find it bugs you. It isn't that important, but you finally bugs you so much, by George, you're going to find this thing. I searched from Thursday till Sunday, and finally got to be a thing with me. I got to find it. Where is it? So you finally, as John said, you finally build up a sweat, and you work, and you search out all these possibilities, and you expand your mind. And that's work, and that needs to be done. But as you heard in the film last night, I think it was Einstein who said that finally the solution comes when you're eating an apple. And so we went to church on Sunday, and after church, I lay down on the sofa and relaxed. I wanted to take a little nap. I knew what that thing was. I was so relaxed, I busted out laughing. Of course I knew where I was! I was so sure I knew where I was, I didn't even check. I turned over and I slept. I slept and I just smiled the whole time. And then when I got up, I looked in Doris's drawer. Of course! What makes us think that, you know, we're always looking for something where we expect it to be and we can't find it? You know, it's just like the guy who is looking for it with a light beam, say, so he can find it. And the reason we can't find things is that we're always looking where we expect it to be. Of course it isn't there. That's why you can't find it. You have to go where it is, where you don't expect it to be. So this, I think, the story really points out that finally you work so hard and there's so much input, then when your mind finally relaxes and you can get all the stuff out of there it is. And that's a great moment. Okay, that's the moment of insight. But you have to have all that sweat ahead of time. You have to get all worked up. The solution is easy.
We have a joke in our family, and I don't know if I can communicate it to you. But it starts out, well, you see, there are these two pheasants walking across our driveway. And in our family, everybody breaks out laughing. They just fall on the floor whenever anybody says that. And it sort of relates to this. And the boys come home from school and they say, "Dad, I have to write a paper on the Hoover Dam. Or I have to write a paper about what I did last summer." And all these papers get so obvious, and I'm a teacher, and I hate to read these term papers because they all start out the same way. Well, before we can address ourselves to the subject, we have to have a little background information about such and such. And then there are 10 pages of background information and one sentence on the thesis. So all of the papers in our house start out from this unexpected point of view. "Well, you see, teacher, there were these two pheasants walking down the driveway." And then the kids start working with that problem and how to get from there to the Hoover Dam. And it takes them in devious ways, down, underneath, and up and over. And they come at the Hoover Dam from a point of view that's just rationally impossible. You can't get there from a helicopter or from a tunnel. And I think it's produced some good results. I guess it's pretty much like what you were talking about. That's work too, but you start off by doing something else. And I guess, I think in a painting, I showed some slides the other day and I wanted to paint white snow, and so I started out painting black and purple and fuchsia. Just because it seems so obvious to start painting white snow, this sort of beating around the bush business. Well, we've got 20 minutes.
I have another story.
All right.
This is not a true story, but it's a story I like to tell. To point out another aspect of the creative act, and that is the act of destruction. And I don't really like to use the word destruction, and maybe it relates to the use of violence today, and I don't want to really get into that too much. But let me tell my story. Before an entirely brand new idea can be born, something old has to die. In many cases, the two are not compatible. Just like Henry Ford, when he decided to go from horse to automobile, he didn't put the wheels on a horse, or he didn't put the horse in back of the car and made a car with the horse still in it. By George, the horse had to go. The horse had to go and die and be done with and quit because the motor was taking over. He wasn't going to drag a horse along. Okay, so that's one point. There's a destructive act. You have to kill the old before the new is born. And another thing is that I want to talk about the opposition, where time and society goes like this, and finally before something new can be born, there has to be some head knocking going on. Let me just tell you this hypothetical situation. Fred and George are neighbors, and they're good friends, and they live across the street from each other. And Fred has a garden, and he's always watering the lawn and so forth. Well, let's go back a little bit further when the garden hose was first invented. And before the garden hose was invented, we had a pump was over here and the garden was there. And the most logical way of watering the garden was to put the water in the bucket and you carry it to the garden and a little sprinkling can and sprinkle the water. Great. And that worked until people got tired of carrying the water and someone invented a garden hose. Well, that was a good idea to convey the water from the source in a rubber tubing and it had an opening on the end. Now we can take the water from the house to the garden to the hole. Well, that was a kind of an invention. I don't really know who invented it. And so Fred is out there watering his garden. He has a hose and he waters his garden. And his neighbor keeps coming over and they talk over the garden wall. And the hose, as it gets older, springs leaks. Well, when you have a leak over here, and the water is not going to the end, that's a no-no, and that's a bad thing. So every time there's a leak, Fred goes in the house, and he takes up the leak. So when he takes up the leak, it's good again. So pretty soon, the garden hose has all this tape on it. So Fred is out there watering the grass one day, talking to his neighbor, and he notices there's another leak. And Fred experiences a moment of insight.
And he runs into the house and gets a nail and a hammer, and he, with a fiendish look in his eye, he punches holes in this hole all the way from one end to the other, and he's destroying this nice round tube. And his neighbor runs in the house, he closes the door, he says, Fred is mad, he's ruining his holes. And then with the last gesture, Fred takes a potato and he pushes it, closes up the end, and now his garden hose sprinkles water all the way from the house to the garden with these little sprinkles. You see, he invented a new hose, which you can buy in a hardware store today. And maybe Fred doesn't water his hose anymore. Maybe he's made so much money on this invention that he can hire somebody to do it. And now that the whole world has accepted this idea, now his neighbor talks to him again. And this is just an example to show that Fred had to oppose all the things that society stood for in regard to garden holes. That it had to be clean with no holes. He puts holes on the end, which is open, he closes. And he did all the bad things. And through all these oppositions, he creates this new thing. You see. That was a moment of madness, sheer illogical madness, which you have to survive. You see. Until everybody else says, no, it's just a bad idea. It's just like the first, I was thinking about the first Christmas tree. Can you imagine before Christmas tree? Can you imagine that before Christmas tree? Someone said that Martin Luther invented the first Christmas tree. I don't know, but can you imagine somebody saying, being some stars to the Christmas tree, to the evergreen tree, and you started to be kind of nice to say now. So imagine there's never been a Christmas tree at Christmas time ever, and somebody chopped down an evergreen tree and dragged it down through the main street of his little town. Everybody thinks he's got wood for the fireplace, and he goes up in the front porch with the tree, and he's confronted with his wife, who meets him at the front door, and she had just cleaned the house. Martin, what in the world's going on? He says, well, I thought it'd be nice to bring a tree on. What are you going to do with it? Well, I thought I'd put it in our living room. Well, you can't be bring a tree on living room. What do you want to do that for? Well, I thought it'd be nice. We'd hang some popcorn on it and stuff. Imagine this dialogue at the front door at the moment the Christmas tree was born, see? And how the neighbors shut their doors because something was happening. Now, you know that you get the whole world to accept Christmas trees inside of buildings and churches and stuff. That has to be the most wild idea anybody ever thought of. Why do we accept that? Who says we ought to have trees in our house? And sometimes we forget that a lot of things we do, we had to be born, and that birth was a moment of madness. And so I think, I don't want to get into the violence of today, but you can see what I just said, that we are entering the 20th century sluggishly and slowly and grudgingly, that finally there has to be someone who is saying, knocking heads and saying, we've got to change. This is always painful. We don't want to let go of the security blanket. We don't want to let go of all these things. But really, maybe there is a better age. Maybe there is a better idea. Personally, I believe that we're undergoing this change in society, and it's not always good, and it's not always the most pleasant thing when people are closing doors to new ideas and are shutting, they're not looking at Fred and Martin Luther and all these things, and all the neighbors are shutting doors and there's this animosity. You see? And maybe we are undergoing a creative act right now. In a sense, I agree. As I said before, I'm against violence, I'm against all these things, but I have a feeling about it, that this needs to go on.
Could you call this violence just asking questions?
Yes, I think so.
I remember Herb was trying to help me write a play last year, and we went for a walk, and he made me ask questions about a very obvious theme by the end of the walk. I mean, he helped me ask questions so I could ask better questions.
Mm-hmm.
And maybe ultimately a painting or a crystal structure or a history relationship or any of these things gets to be a series of questions, and the answers get to be more questions.
That's
this
right.
Thing snowballs, but it is destructive.
If there are any questions, well, I think maybe this is all I wanted to say, kind of throw out some ideas if you want to.
I think you've maybe gotten at the reason why people are reluctant to create. You know, like, why don't more people come to your sketching classes? Because maybe they like to, but they're kind of uptight about doing it because they don't think they're any good. And I think you can let go maybe easier and feel like holding them because they sort of build up this non-stopping atmosphere. Because so many people say to them, when you go home, you don't do these things. So why can't we create this in our congregation too, so that people can be creative?
That's interesting. Is Holden destructive or constructive?
No, I think it's a good thing. You know, it allows for you to do this without somebody making fun of it. Which is a lot of new stuff. Like, I was syndicating the flower boxes in my town. You know, I can't imagine volunteering to the city council. I'll paint the flower boxes for you.
Huh? I did.
Did you?
Yeah.
Good. I would
do that. We drove
apart.
We built a park. I smashed thumbs on four of
them. I think Holden is destructive in a very good way. I went home last summer and thought of all the painful things that I've been doing and decided there must be a more fun way to do it. I give all kinds of dull, dry speeches, and they're hard to write. And I came home last summer and just decided I would never write another speech, and I think I gave lots better speeches than I ever did before. But it was a risky business. I went to chapel and improvised, which I never have done in my life, and it was pretty powerful. I don't know that my drawing class is exceptionally creative. We've been going at it pretty rational, but it's a start. Well, I'd like to advertise here that it doesn't take anything but reasonable intelligence. But it is a way of making yourself stop and listen to doorknobs and listen to trees and rock forms and spaces, and something might come. I guess that's part of the dimension of the creative moment. It is making relationships.
Yeah, right.
And I think the Psalms at noon are a creative experience. Umau relates Bernie and the water sprinkler and King David and the quart of milk he dropped and fell down and cut his wrists on the glass bottles and the garbage, and all this comes together into a beautiful relationship.
Yeah.
I guess you didn't talk about cutting your wrists on broken milk bottles. If there aren't any questions, does anybody have a testimony?
That's not very creative.
No, they're not at all.
Well, I have a strong belief that this is part of the work of the Holy Spirit in man. I really believe this. That so often when we pray for things, we expect a certain kind of response. But really, God doesn't answer our prayer just that way. Maybe He answers it through a most illogical way, a way we didn't expect. So that kind of we say God is not answering our prayer. But He is answering all the time and giving us opportunity, but we don't, they're in unexpected ways. Some Well, last night in the movie, these arms and legs were going, and the woman said, "Hey, I want to put a flag in a hand." You know, that was an answer that the world wasn't expecting at all, but it was that unexpected answer. And I think that what I said about Christian serendipity, really that the Holy Spirit working in man and giving him all these opportunities, if he only would say yes to life. And when you say yes to him, and you are total yes to your life, then there are all kinds of opportunities, and there are all kinds of answers, and there are ways and means, and it's different than when you say no, no, no. When you say no, and then you're closing up options and opportunities. And I think finally, it is kind of a spiritual thing. It's an affirmation. There's an anonymous quotation said in the 15th century that says, "Let go of thyself and let God act for thee," which I like. So he has to.
I often watch a lot of the church, how they be great, and the whole process of being high and low, repentance and forgiveness, a long life, and long faith, and their educational life, and their experience. No wonder it has become so.
For the moment, non-religious. Because it doesn't have a power, let alone religion. Mm-hmm. I think we're
just about kind of along the same lines. We're talking about creativity and leadership.
Thank you.
like children picking up nails and dropping glass, all these things that seem so illogical. Why do you have a lot of string in your pocket and why do you have a lot of things like that?
I think sometimes when I hear what you said, when a child is born, you already begin to kill it. It's what is often called a piggyback, where you affirm what the person ahead of you has said, so that you are truly listening and adding or building on to it. Instead of, while he's talking, you're thinking of something else that you can make your speech, and this is the type of going on and taking the risk that wherever he or she is where you will somehow
that, and that's where the really wild can tell them, like somebody said something about overweight once in a scene and so a guy was a balloon, you know, and really far out things can happen. And you know, it's funny if you pick up the images you get in your mind and you read something like it. It's really
this is photography in Minnesota, where it seemed as though the man took 20 pictures and you're going to pick out the one for you. He would do another thing with one of the videos he chose, and these are the ones that he did without. It was just the moment before, and he wrote it. But everybody else says that's exactly who you are, and none of them have one to think that it's a bad report. And these are all things.
Picking up on your piggybacking on your curve, and the preconceived notion, but it seems to me that the only failure is when we relate it to the preconceived notion. The real failure is not picking up what you learned from not making your preconceived notion and moving on from there. With that movement, and that's never a lot miserably in something from the preconceived notion. And man, it created going from there. So I hear you and the young gal out there.
Yeah. Okay. Let me ask you a question. What part do you think discipline plays in the creative process?
Well, I sort of underlined that with my emphasis on hard work.
So you just don't sit around waiting for the Holy Spirit, right?
No, I think you open yourself up to these possibilities through some kind of action. In my case, most of the time it's just busy work, kind of nervous fidgeting. But it is or nervously doing my piano exercises.
I think to answer your question, it might be interesting to note that there's been all the young people today who are doing their thing and who are free and undisciplined. There has not been a great artist who has come out of any of this movement. In other words, they lack this some kind of dedication or devotion or something that you really work for. The people who are just popping out and not undisciplined. There is nothing coming out that is really truly free and creative. So I think it's proof that there has to be some kind of striving. You striving towards something, searching and molding everything towards something, and there has to be search and work and sweat. And without that, I don't think anything can happen, because there's an output, there has to be input. What are you putting in? If there's no input, even a computer doesn't do anything unless you put something in. Then it comes out. A computer is nothing without input. And so the human mind, the human body, is nothing unless there's some input. It's just the best.
That would be like saying that we have to have the tools with which to create. It may not be simply an extension of skills. I mean, as somebody said, I'm like, genius is 90% person. perspiration and things are kind of inspiration, but you gotta have that nitrogen in that first.
May I ask, what is your name?
Mary.
Mary, when you were doing what, demonstration, what are some of the disciplines that you were,
that we had to do before we were ready to.
Yep.
A lot of them had to do with building a trust between the eight elements and working together in one, so that if somebody sees something ahead and you didn't deny it, or you didn't say, no, I'm not expecting it, you say, yeah, and then you still are. We did a lot of exercises that didn't have a problem, different things, you know, touching things. Something that our director said was just thinking about continuing to use everything you have as far as being aware of what's happening. And maybe that can be fine, but, you know, something like it was pretty good in this kind of thing.
Did you sort out?
Mm-hmm.
As you gather everything, did you all report?
Well, I couldn't say, consciously, I hope not. I mean, I couldn't organize what would be good to me and why. You know, the people who really could come up with these wild things, the people who just sort of, you know, threw themselves into whatever was happening, and, you know, let themselves be moved in and then talk to them.
Can I interrupt? There's a new session about to start, and I got to get in one last look. Raymond handed me a poem about a new created Catholic Church, and he's a pretty simple. He is in the church.
I'm Catholic, and I'm a commentator. And,
you should read this.
All right. As commentator, we have our little thing to do, and a few epistles to read. And as you know, Catholic Church has changed quite a bit, and is going to continue to change, I'm sure. Hopefully, to some extent, organized change a little bit. But some young lady in St. Paul was very upset and unhappy about much of the change. And she wrote what I thought was a pretty good poem, and the next time I'm going to commentate a church, I'm going to read it. It's entitled, A New Way of Church Rules. Latin's gone, peace is too, singing and shouting from every pew. Altars turned around, priestess too. Commentators yelling, page 22. When your rail's gone, stand up straight. Kneeling suddenly went out of date. Processions are forming in every aisle. Salvation organized, single file. Rosaries out, psalms are in. Hardly ever hear a word against sin. Listen to the lector, hear how he reads. Please stop rattling those rosary beads. Father's looking puzzled, he doesn't know his part. He used to know the whole deal in Latin by heart. I hope all changes are just about done and they don't drop bingo before I've won.
I'll have drawing on the lawn in front of Chalet 1 for an hour, and then we all who didn't see the film last night should go to the film at 4.
Film at 4? 3.
4. Over at the Lily Center at 4 because of the playwright.
Oh. And Edna Hong is here on creativity in the Sunday school from 3 to 4.